tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock on BBC Radio 4.
Back to today, and after the news in a quarter of an hour, Professor Tanya Byron talks about sleep, plus women in South African politics. That's Women's Hour with Jenny Murray. Now on BBC Radio 4, the Book of the Week. In the world until yesterday, Pulitzer Prize winner author Jared Diamond examines the ways in which traditional societies can provide unique, often overlooked, insights into human nature. Today, he compares traditional societies' attitudes to play and learning with those in the West. The reader is Crawford Logan.
On one of my visits to New Guinea, I met a young man named Enu, whose life story struck me then as remarkable. Enu had grown up in an area where child-rearing was extremely repressive and where children were heavily burdened by obligations and by feelings of guilt. By the time he was 5 years old, Enu decided that he had had enough of that lifestyle. He left his parents and most of his relatives and moved to another tribe and village where he had relatives willing to take care of him. There, Enu found himself in an adoptive society with laissez-faire child-rearing practices at the opposite extreme from his natal society's practices. Young children were considered to have responsibility for their own actions and were allowed to do pretty much as they pleased. For example, if a baby was playing next to a fire, adults did not intervene. Both of those styles of child-rearing would be rejected with horror in Western industrial societies today. But the laissez-faire style of Enu's adoptive society is not unusual by the standards of the world's hunter-gatherer societies, many of which consider young children to be autonomous individuals whose desires should not be thwarted and who are allowed to play with dangerous objects such as sharp knives, hot pots, and fires. Why should we be interested in child-rearing practices of traditional hunter-gatherer, farmer, and herder societies? There are compelling practical reasons. Small-scale societies offer us a vast database on child-rearing. They reveal the outcomes of thousands of natural experiments on how to rear children. Western state societies would not permit us to carry out the experiments that Enu lived through of either extreme repression or extreme laissez-faire. While few would consider it admirable to let children roll into fires, many other traditional child-rearing practices do recommend themselves for consideration. Thus, another reason for studying traditional societies is that they can inform our own choices. They may suggest practices different from those now routine in the West. After the first night that I spent in a New Guinea highland village, I woke up the next morning to hear the shouts of village boys playing outside my hut. Instead of playing hopscotch or pulling toy cars, they were playing tribal war. It was a realistic imitation of an actual highland war, except that the arrows were non-lethal, the participants were boys rather than men, and they belonged to the same village and were laughing. This game that introduced me to life in the New Guinea highlands is typical of so-called educational play of children around the world. Much child play is imitation of adult activities that the children see or hear about in stories told by adults. The kids play for fun, but their play serves the function of letting them practice things that they will later have to do as adults. A regular feature of the games of hunter-gatherer societies is their lack of competition or contests. Whereas many of our games in the West involve keeping score and are about winning and losing, it is rare for hunter-gatherer games to keep score or identify a winner. Instead, games of small-scale societies often involve sharing to prepare children for adult life that emphasizes sharing and discourages contests. Modern societies differ from traditional societies in the number, source, and claimed function of toys. Toy manufacturers heavily promote so-called educational toys to foster so-called creative play. Parents are taught to believe that manufactured, store-bought toys are important to the development of their children. In contrast, traditional societies have few or no toys, and any toys that do exist are made either by the child itself or by the child's parents. An American friend who spent his childhood in rural Kenya told me that some of his Kenyan friends were very inventive and used sticks and string to build their own small cars with wheels and axles. One day, my friend and his Kenyan friend tried to harness a pair of giant Goliath beetles to pull a toy cart that they had built. The two boys spent a whole afternoon at their game, but despite hours of effort, they could not get the two beetles to pull in coordination. When my friend returned as a teenager to the United States and watched American children playing with their plastic, ready-made, store-bought toys, he gained the impression that American children are less creative than Kenyan children. In modern state societies, there is formal education, schools and after-hour classes, in which specially trained instructors teach children as an activity separate from play. But education in small-scale societies is not a separate activity. For instance, among Africa's Mbuti pygmies studied by Colin Turnbull, children imitate their parents by playing with a tiny bow and arrow, a strip of a hunting net, or a miniature basket, and by building a miniature house, catching frogs, and chasing a cooperative grandparent who agrees to pretend to be an antelope. Turnbull writes, "For children, life is one long frolic interspersed with a healthy sprinkle of spankings and slappings. And one day they find that the games they have been playing are not games any longer, but the real thing, for they have become adults. The hunting is now real hunting. Their tree climbing is in earnest search of inaccessible honey. Their acrobatics on the swings are repeated almost daily in other forms, in the pursuit of elusive game, or in avoiding the malicious forest buffalo. It happens so gradually that they hardly notice the change at first, for even when they are proud and famous hunters, their life is still full of fun and laughter." Whereas for small-scale societies, education follows naturally from social life, in some modern societies, even the rudiments of social life require explicit education. For example, in parts of modern American cities where people do not know their neighbours, and where car traffic and potential kidnappers and a lack of pavements mean that children cannot safely walk to play with friends, children have to be taught formally how to play with other children in classes termed Mummy and Me classes. There, a mother brings her child to a classroom with a trained teacher and a dozen other children and their mothers. The children sit in an inner circle, the mothers in an outer circle, and gain experience of child play, and the children are taught how to take turns speaking, listening, and handing objects back and forth to other children. There are many features of modern American society that my New Guinea friends consider bizarre, but nothing astonished them more than being told that American children need specified places, times, and instruction in order to learn how to meet and play with each other. There is also great variation among human societies in their attitudes towards punishing children. However, there does seem to be a broad trend. Most hunter-gatherer bands do minimal physical punishment of young children, many farming societies do some punishment, and herders are especially likely to punish. One contributing explanation is that misbehaviour by a hunter-gatherer child will probably hurt only the child and not anyone or anything else, because hunter-gatherers tend to have few valuable physical possessions. But many farmers, and especially herders, do have valuable material things, especially valuable livestock, so herders punish children to prevent serious consequences to the whole family. For example, if a child fails to close the pasture gates, valuable cows and sheep can run away. Among the people of the Trobriand Islands near New Guinea, who are farmers without livestock except for pigs, children are neither punished nor expected to obey. The ethnographer Bronislav Malinowski wrote of the Trobriand Islanders, "Often I would hear a youngster told to do this or that, and generally the thing, whatever it was, would be asked as a favour, though sometimes the request might be backed up by a threat of violence. The parent would either coax or scold or ask as from one equal to another. A simple command, implying the expectation of natural obedience, is never heard from parents to child in the Trobriand. When I suggested, after some flagrant infantile misdeed, that it would mend matters for the future if the child were beaten or otherwise punished in cold blood, the idea appeared unnatural and immoral to my Trobriand friends. A tentative generalization is that individual autonomy, even of children, is a more cherished ideal in hunter-gatherer bands than in state societies where the state considers that it has an interest in its children, does not want children to get hurt by doing as they please, and forbids parents to let a child harm itself. Recently, I picked up a rental car at an American airport. The recording that was broadcast to us passengers on the shuttle bus from the airport baggage reclaim to the rental car park warned us, "Federal law requires children under 5 years of age or weighing under 80 pounds to be transported in a federally approved car seat." Hunter-gatherers would consider that warning to be none of the business of anyone other than the child and perhaps its parents. Some hunter-gatherer societies don't intervene when children are doing dangerous things that may in fact harm them and that could expose a Western parent to criminal prosecution. Here is an incident observed by Daniel Everett among the Pirahã Indians. "We noticed that a Pirahã toddler, about 2 years old, was sitting in the hut behind the man we were interviewing. The child was playing with a sharp kitchen knife about 9 inches in length. He was swinging the knife blade around him, often coming close to his eyes, his chest, his arm, and other body parts one would not like to slice off or perforate. What really got our attention, though, was that when he dropped the knife, his mother, talking to someone else, reached back nonchalantly without interrupting her conversation, picked up the knife, and handed it back to the toddler. No one told him not to cut himself or hurt himself with the knife, and he didn't. But I have seen other Pirahã children cut themselves severely with knives." I find myself thinking a lot about the New Guinea people with whom I have been working for the last 49 years, and about the comments of Westerners who have lived for years in hunter-gatherer societies and watched children grow up there. A recurring theme is that the other Westerners and I are struck by the emotional security, self-confidence, curiosity, and autonomy of members of small-scale societies, not only as adults, but already as children. We see that people in small-scale societies spend far more time talking to each other than we do, and they spend no time at all on passive entertainment supplied by outsiders, such as television, video games, and books. We are struck by the precocious development of social skills in their children. These are qualities that most of us admire and would like to see in our own children. But we discourage development of those qualities by ranking and grading our children and constantly telling them what to do. At minimum, one can say that hunter-gatherer rearing practices that seem so foreign to us aren't disastrous and they don't produce societies of obvious sociopaths. Instead, they produce individuals capable of coping with big challenges and dangers while still enjoying their lives. The hunter-gatherer lifestyle worked at least tolerably well for the nearly 100,000-year history of behaviorally modern humans. Everybody in the world was a hunter-gatherer until the local origins of agriculture around 11,000 years ago. And nobody in the world lived under a state government until 5,400 years ago. The lessons from all those experiments in child-rearing that lasted for such a long time are worth considering seriously.
The World Until Yesterday was produced by Christine Cameron. With archive recordings, Professor Robert Winston charts the unique race to discover the double helix.
We used to occasionally Jim and I, sit and look at the molecule and think how beautiful it was. And I remember an occasion when Jim gave a talk to a little biophysics club we had. It's true they gave him one or two drinks before dinner. It was rather a short talk because all he could say at the end was, "Well, you see, it's so pretty."
DNA 60 Years On is on Saturday evening at 8 here on BBC Radio 4.